You've heard our open themes with listeners talking about their vocations.
Missouri dairy farmers, love issues, etc.
And what they're doing while listening to issues, etc.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love issues, etc.
We're looking for more of these elements to include in our open themes. Tell us about your vocation, hobby, or what you do while listening to Issues Etc. Call the Issues Etc. comment line 24/7 at 618-223-8382. If you make a mistake, just start over. 618-223-8382. Thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing to Issues Etc. 618-223-8382.
Creating a genderless marriage institution would have to break down the connection between parenthood and biology.
But as I was growing up, how often did I hear marriage preached about in any substantial way? Not often, and that's probably due to the divorce culture that made us probably quiet about teaching what marriage is and why it matters.
If the Lord could save Peter, who denied his Lord three times, then he can save you. If the Lord can save that one who persecuted the very church of God and Christ himself, consenting to the martyrdom of his saints, then he can save you.
When driving to and from work through the Las Vegas Valley and den of iniquity, I always hit the jackpot by listening to Issues Etc.
It is being called the Red Team, Blue Team exercise. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt is making what I think is pretty modest suggestion. Because climate change remains politically controversial and because of the solutions that are being proposed, not just for the United States, but for really the entire world, would be sweeping, wouldn't it be a good idea? And since there's still people who seriously doubt, uneducated, unscientific people like me, who may have serious doubts about the human origins of climate change, wouldn't it be a good idea for those who want to argue for human origin to climate change and those who want to question those arguments to talk about it in public, to debate the evidence, to present the evidence before we move ahead as a nation and really in the course of the entire globe on ideas that, well, we're being told are rock solid science, but if those who believe this is rock solid silence refuse to debate, what does that tell us? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Thursday afternoon, the 6th of July. We're going to be talking about the refusal of climate change scientists to publicly debate the issue. Dr. Cal Beisner of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation will be our guest. A little bit later, we continue our series, Christ in the Old Testament, in Isaiah chapter 26. You keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee. Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer will be our guest. Feel free to join us with your questions or your comments over the course of the next hour, 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. Our Twitter address, @issuesetc. And for our beloved on-demand listeners, whenever, wherever you listen, there's the Issues Etc. listener comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about the refusal of climate change scientists to publicly debate the issue, Dr. Cal Beisner, founder and national spokesman for the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, author of the book Where Garden Meets Wilderness, Evangelical Entry into the Environmental Debate. Dr. Beisner, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you very much. Great to be back with you.
We are told repeatedly that there is scientific consensus on the human origins of climate change. This is repeated routinely in news reports and things like this. How would you describe the consensus, such as it is, on human origins for climate change?
Well, I think we can say pretty safely that there is very, very strong scientific consensus that the Earth's atmosphere, the lower troposphere, has warmed by about 1 degree Celsius since about 1850. The stratosphere, however, has cooled a little bit during the same period. That's because of the physics of how the whole greenhouse effect works. We could also say that there's strong scientific consensus that human activity has probably contributed something to that warming. That's as far as the consensus goes. Now, we're constantly told that the overwhelming scientific consensus, 97% of all climate scientists, or even 97% of all scientists, agree that that global warming is happening, that it's real, that it's dangerous, that it is overwhelmingly man-made, and that if we don't spend trillions of dollars trying to stop it, we're headed for catastrophe. The fact is that none of the studies that purport to find consensus finds consensus on any of the issues in terms of whether it is dangerous and whether human activity is the primary cause of it, and certainly on whether it makes any sense to spend anything trying to prevent it, let alone trillions of dollars.
How long have we actually been accurately measuring the temperatures around the globe? I mean, we're given the impression that we have like records going back to 1,000 years, which just kind of a simple examination might prove to be ridiculous. How long have we been measuring the atmosphere with any kind of scientific accuracy?
Well, it depends on how you define accuracy. Even today, with the very best methods that we have, which are satellite instruments that infer temperature from the frequency of vibration of molecules in the atmosphere, which can be read via microwave sending units on satellites that NASA has up in space. Even today, with those, we cannot get better than, oh, say, a tenth of a degree Celsius as global average surface temperature. And frankly, there I'm being pretty generous. I happen to think that it's more likely in the neighborhood of half a degree Celsius. And that's, you know, that may sound like pretty accurate, but the fact is that the claims of, you know, hottest year on record, for example, supposedly 2016 is the hottest year on record. Well, the difference between 2016 and 1998, the second hottest year, was only 0.02 of a degree, which is far less than the margin of error of that best measurement system that we have. And that measurement system only goes back to 1979. So when we hear about warmest on record, well, the record is only about 38 years now, and that's not an awful long time in terms of geologic history. We can be reasonably confident of thermometer readings going back perhaps, 60 or 70 years, but much beyond that, there simply were nowhere near enough monitoring stations around the world to give us any sort of a representative sample. And then, of course, we have to turn to proxy measures like the thickness of tree rings, which depends in part on temperature, for anything going back more than a couple of hundred years. And all of those proxy measures are themselves contaminated by all sorts of other factors. So we really can't say anything terribly precise on these things, other than to know that, for instance, when grapes grew in northern Scotland, when Greenland was green and had settlements on it, it has to have been warmer than it is today, which tells us the medieval warm period was warmer than today.
So it sounds as though, just in terms of the data that is being interpreted, and that's an important point, the data always needs interpretation. There's a lot of noise in that data, and it's also a very, very small sample, relatively speaking, to the kind of what changes that are being purported to take place.
Yes, until we get to the satellite record, beginning in 1979, actually December of 1978. And there, the satellites are able to measure temperature at pretty much all altitudes, pretty much all latitudes, pretty much all longitudes, 24/7, 365. That's a very, very representative sample. And it's really quite reliable. There are some inaccuracies in that. There are some difficulties in exactly how to to interpret some of the readings from the instruments on the satellites, which is why there are two different organizations that try to do that interpreting. One is at the University of Alabama, and it's headed up by a Cornwall Alliance senior fellow, Dr. Roy Spencer, and his colleague, Dr. John Christie. And another is at Remote Sensing Systems out in California. And to give you an idea of how easy it is to get confused on these things, recently the folks at Remote Sensing Systems, RSS, published a paper in which they reported the results of a readjustment of the temperature data that they get from the satellites. And it's the same satellites that the University of Alabama folks use, but they adjusted their understanding of those. And the result was a slight increase in the apparent rate of warming over the period from 1979 to the present. Well, that got reported in headlines as warming is happening 240% faster than previously understood. What people weren't recognizing is that was 240% of something incredibly slow anyway, and the result still was that even according to their adjusted figures, the warming is happening at a rate that is somewhere around half of the rate predicted by computer climate models, which are the only basis for fears of dangerous warming.
So with what you've said here, does it surprise you that when the proposal to have this, as it's being called, red team, blue team exercise, where the evidence is to be publicly debated, this is being suggested by EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, does it surprise you that many scientists are refusing to debate?
Oh, that doesn't surprise me at all, because frankly, the alarmist scientists have refused to debate their critics for a couple of decades now. They've been saying that the debate is over. The problem is that, of course, the data indicate something other than that. The best data we have in terms of temperature indicate that the global climate models run on computers call for warming to be happening at a rate that is anywhere from 2 to 3 times as fast as the actual measured temperatures are. That means the models are wrong, and if they're wrong, they provide no rational basis for any predictions about future temperature or for any policies having to do with them. But you see, if you are committed to a position, and if your government-funded research depends on that position, then you don't want it challenged, and that's why you're unwilling to debate. Now, what's really ironic to me is that it was Dr. Stephen Koonin, who was Undersecretary of Energy for Science during President Obama's first term, who prominently endorsed the idea of a red team, blue team approach in a Wall Street Journal article on April 20. And, you know, some people object to that, but as Koonin put it, you know, the process of a red team, blue team approach is now considered a best practice in high consequence situations such as intelligence assessments, spacecraft design, and major industrial operations. And when some people argue, oh, but we already have peer review, Koonin dispensed with that objection by saying it is very different and more rigorous than traditional peer review, which is usually confidential and always adjudicated rather than public and moderated. The difference between adjudicated and moderated is this. In peer review, if your article gets rejected, it's over. In a red team, blue team approach, it's moderated, which means that the argument continues. And that's a very important thing because, frankly, there is not an end to this argument, certainly not at this point.
And the implication there is that peer review can be, that process can be abused to simply silence unpopular scientific opinions or even, even data.
So. Yeah, definitely so. In fact, the release of thousands of emails from the University of East Anglia back in 2009 showed very, very clearly that a small cadre, about a dozen and a half of climate scientists affiliated with the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, mostly in the UK and the United States, had already corrupted the peer review process so that articles by scientists who would challenge the claim of dangerous man-made warming were not getting accepted. They were intimidating scientists from publishing contrary data. They were fabricating data. They were exaggerating data. They were suppressing contrary data. And they were intimidating editors from accepting articles of that sort. And that has continued since then. Peer review has been a highly corrupted process in the whole climate change controversy.
So it would look like, not so much a classic debate, but it would look like a rigorous back and forth, looking at the same evidence, evaluating it. Would the public, would the average person be able to glean anything from these conversations if they were to take place, this red team, blue team process?
Yeah, you know, I actually think that the average person would be able to gain a lot. You know, one of the insights of C.S. Lewis was that a truly great thinker can make difficult concepts clear for ordinary people, for non-experts. And that's what really needs to happen, because frankly, policy decisions on this are going to be made not by scientists who, after all, don't have expertise in politics, they don't have expertise in economics, they don't have expertise in policy making. Policy is going to be made by legislators, by administrators, by bureaucrats, etc. And these are people who are themselves non-scientists. So what goes on in the red team, blue team debates, conversations, back and forth, is going to have to be done in a way that ordinary people can follow.
Do you think it's going to happen? Do you think that there is going to be some rather brave or more honest climate change, human origin climate change advocates who say, look, I'm happy to sit down and to debate this? Maybe somebody who doesn't have so much research money on the line.
Well, I'll tell you what I think is going to happen if they don't do it. The present administration is led by a president who has said that he thinks that the whole claim of man-made climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. Now, I think he's wrong to think that, but nonetheless, he is the president. The current administrator of the EPA, Scott Pruitt, firmly believes that there is plenty of scientific reason to question whether human activity is the primary driver of recent global warming and to question whether it's dangerous. Likewise, the present Secretary of the Department of Energy, Rick Perry, thinks very similarly. So these people, the elected president and these Senate-confirmed agency heads are going to pursue this direction. And that means if the alarmists want to continue to be heard, they'd better get on the playing field.
So, in a nutshell, how would you explain why so many leading climate change scientists are afraid to debate the issue upon which many of them have made their very careers?
All kinds of reasons, I suppose. But I think, frankly, the biggest one is simply that they know that the actual empirical data themselves do not support the policies that they're trying to push. And that's a really important thing for the public to keep in mind, is that these are scientists who are pressing for particular policies, such as, for instance, the Paris Climate Accord. And pursuing policies is a very different thing from answering a climate science-related question. Now, if we ask the question, how much warming happens in response to, say, doubling the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from the pre-industrial 280 parts per million to about 560 parts per million, that's 56,000th of 1% of the atmosphere, right? If we ask the question, how much warming comes from that, that's a scientific question. But when we ask, how should we respond to that? That's not a scientific question. That's a policy question. It has moral aspects. It has economic aspects. It has political aspects. And all of that has to be approached. And the scientists who are so adamant that we cannot debate these things are frankly wanting us to accept their policy expertise when that's not the expertise they have. It's a science expertise. And then they're also wanting us to bow to their science expertise instead of the science expertise of literally thousands of other scientists who disagree with them over that. When we're asked, for instance, in the Paris Treaty, to embrace a policy that, even if it were fully implemented, would only reduce global average temperature by 0.17 of a degree Celsius at the end of this century, or 0.3 of a degree Fahrenheit, and that would cost between $1 and $2 trillion per year from 2030 to the end of the century, i.e., we're buying every 0.1 of a degree Fahrenheit reduction in temperature at a price of $23.3 to $46.6 trillion. When we're asked that, doggone, the reasons had better be convincing.
Dr. Cal Beisner is founder and national spokesman for the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. He's author of the book, Where Garden Meets Wilderness, Evangelical Entry into the Environmental Debate. You can purchase this book and find out more about the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation at issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Cal, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you very much, Todd. And cornwallalliance.org has literally hundreds of good articles and papers that people can read for further education on this.
Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer is with us on the other side of the break. We're going to be continuing our weekly series, Christ in the Old Testament. Today we'll be in Isaiah chapter 26, and we'll begin talking about a connection to chapter 25 and a strong city. Stay tuned.
I bet you didn't know that the teaching of Latin in schools is making a comeback. Latin? Really? Isn't that a dead language? Well, take a look at what studies say about how well Latin students do on a test like the SAT. Memoria Press's Latin program will revolutionize your students' vocabulary, knowledge, and their understanding of grammar. And there is no better subject for teaching critical thinking skills. Visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR.
Things when I hear on the radio tonight about Obama being a Christian but not being good because of his pro-choice and homosexuality stances.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Yet I see no evidence of any literature that in the Bible that you stated that says that these things are against biblical teachings.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
At Concordia University Irvine, you can pursue advanced theological study for academic, professional, or personal development. Concordia's Master of Arts in Theology program is grounded in the truth of Scripture and insights from the Lutheran Confessions. Courses are taught online and at intensive on-campus sessions in the summer. Apologetics, Christian education leadership, and Reformation studies are just a few of the emphases offered. For more information, visit cui.edu/theology.